Chapter 12, Contracts, Decisions, and the Night of the Eighth Iron. Another month disappeared, and I still waited. I was no longer sure whether Liverpool would offer me a new contract. The text messages flew in from local football correspondents. "What's happening?" they asked me. "Have the owners been in touch? Will you be here next season?" They made up a loop of three interlinked queries, and the answer to both the first and last question was a simple, "I don't know." The middle question could be answered with a straight no. My agent had yet been contacted by the club's owners, or by Ian Eyre. Strawn had only spoken to Brendan Rodgers, who told him what he told me in numerous chats in his office over the past few months. Brendan wanted to keep me. It just needed Fenway and Eyre to pick up the phone and talk to Strawn to sort out a deal that suited me at this stage of my career. I had known some of the writers for a long time, and I sensed their surprise. I was in my 27th year at the club, stretching back to my first signing of form in spidery handwriting to join the Liverpool Centre of Excellence at the age of 8. I was approaching my 700th game for Liverpool's first team, and I had been club captain since 2003. It was not as if I was just a kid looking for a new deal. My age was an obvious factor, and I was realistic enough to know that I was approaching the end of my career. I was willing to discuss a new contract on that basis, especially as Brendan was emphatic that he wanted me at Liverpool. Yet month after month, August into September, into October, into November, there was only silence from the club I had cherished since I was a very small boy. That love from me towards Liverpool stayed constant. I was not unsettled by the lack of communication. Brendan reassured me that his own conviction had not changed. He still saw me as central to his plans both this season and in 2015-16. I could only assume that the men in charge of the club's finances were stalling and avoiding early negotiations with Strawn, or that they thought there was no rush. Maybe they thought it was a foregone conclusion that I would stay. In late October, I was asked by one of my two main sponsors, LucasAid, to agree to an interview with the Daily Telegraph and the Daily Mail. I had been with Adidas and LucasAid for years, and I preferred to focus on working for them rather than collecting a whole range of different sponsors. The latter strategy might have been more lucrative, but I liked being loyal and limiting my commercial work in order to concentrate on football. I was relaxed because the interview would be carried out by Chris Bascom and Ian Ladyman. I had known Chris for years, since he'd been on the Liverpool Echo. I was also comfortable talking to Ian. The interview was published on 30th of October 2014, and I told the writers, "I won't be retiring this summer. I will play beyond this season. We will have to wait and see if that's at Liverpool or somewhere else. That's Liverpool's decision." In terms of quoted material, we left it at that and spoke instead about Liverpool's stuttering start to the season, losing Suarez, and my vague hope that Mario Balotelli might still become a success at Anfield. I was at my diplomatic best in regard to Balotelli. There was no point saying in public I had already begun to lose faith in Mario. In regard to the contract, I could have made more of it, but I still harboured serious hopes that the club would soon talk to Strawn and we could settle on a deal acceptable to both parties. But I was happy to send out a plain message that I would keep playing football, whatever Liverpool decided. We went to Newcastle on 1st of November and lost 1-0 in another fitful display, but attention after the game focused on my lack of a contract. Brendan was quizzed about it, and he was as clear as he could be in the circumstances. "It's quite straightforward. I had a meeting with Stephen's representatives explaining the situation. I very much want him to be a part of what we're doing here. He's been a brilliant captain for me. I relayed that to the ownership. I'm sure everyone will go away with that, and hopefully his representatives will organise a deal. Stephen is very much part of what I'm doing here. He's a unique player, a unique talent." We waited another week and then, finally, Strong got a message from Ian Eyre. The club wanted to offer me a new deal. Could they talk? Strong arranged a meeting with Ian. It was a big day for me. I had high hopes for my final contract from Liverpool, but I just wanted to get it settled so I could get back to thinking only about football. Strong called me after the meeting, much earlier than expected, and I said to him, "How did it go? How long were you in there?" Strong said, 15 to 20 minutes. "Really? 15 minutes? Strong knew why I was surprised. It seemed like a very short meeting to decide the conclusion to my Liverpool career. Strong explained the situation. Liverpool had offered me a deal, but it was pretty much a case of, this is the offer. There was no point in Ian and Strawn talking for any longer after such a clear message. I was at home, listening to Strawn on my mobile. I thought, okay, I've waited this long to find out what they want to do, and this is the offer. It's time to think carefully. Perhaps it was not meant for Liverpool and me to move into a 28th year together. It seemed as if I wanted them more than they wanted me. I was a bit unsure at that point, but I was also much calmer than I had been in 2005. Back then, Ian's counterpart, Rick Parry, had made me wait for a new contract even though we had just won the Champions League final. It had felt then as if my young blood was boiling. I was much more thoughtful at 34, but I was also taken aback. I thought Strawn and Ian would talk for an hour or so and we would move forward positively. In a 15-minute nutshell, Liverpool offered me a new deal. It was a 1-year extension with a 40% pay decrease. The bonuses were very good, but they contradicted everything that Brendan had said to me. Brendan had told me, in a different nutshell, "Look, you're not going to start as many games. We're going to manage your games and your minutes to make sure that you're fresh for the games that really matter." But the club were offering me bonuses for clean sheets, games that I'd start in, goals, assists, and whether we finished in the top four. They were all part of the package. I was confused. My game time was going to become less and less, but they were offering me a contract with performance-related incentives. I had no quibbles with the money being offered. If they had offered me the very same deal in the summer, I would have been happy to sign it. But I had just walked away from England to commit myself to Liverpool. A substantial decrease in my pay was only to be expected. At 34, I was not the player who had lifted the Champions League trophy 10 years earlier. I also understood that I would have to play less, but I still valued myself as a top player and an important part of the team. I was still the captain, and I was disappointed to be offered a performance incentive contract after all my years at the club. I thought that they would have known that, apart from my pride in my own performances and an endearing love for Liverpool, I didn't need any incentive to try my heart out. In a perfect scenario, Liverpool could have offered me a 1-year deal which included the chance to make a transition to the first team staff. Such a deal would have been more appealing than a year as a squad player. A year with Brendan and his staff would have been an invaluable experience, which players like Ryan Giggs, Phil Neville and Gary Monk had enjoyed at other clubs. I believed I could read between the lines to their offer. To me, there was a stark message from Liverpool. Whether we're right or wrong, it feels like it's time. Enjoy your last 6 months with us and then start afresh somewhere else. Since our poor Champions League performance in Basel, we had lost twice to Real Madrid, 3-0 at Anfield and 1-0 at the Bernabeu. We were set up correctly at home against Madrid. I played as one of two holding midfielders and we were more compact and we did try for the tactical cage around their main players. When Ronaldo had the ball, we quickly got two or three around them. But the problem playing Madrid was that they had five or six world-class players. You might stifle one, but then the other five would have more freedom. There was a gulf in class and Real were in their best form. They had the swagger and confidence of champions. We played well in patches and caused them a few problems, but we didn't have a single forward who could put away the chances. Balotelli was in trouble again. He swapped shirts with Pepe as he walked off at half-time. The manager was understandably unimpressed. Mario was replaced at the break. The return match in Madrid made me nostalgic for March 2009. We had beaten Madrid 5-0 on aggregate in the knockout stages, winning 1-0 away and 4-0 at Anfield. The home demolition was one of the sweetest nights in European football, and it prompted Zinedine Zidane to make his generous claim about me. He's the best player in the world. Forget about Messi. Forget about Ronaldo. It's Gerrard. I got 2 goals at Anfield and Fernando Torres and Andrea De Sena scored as well. We had a good team, with Mascherano and Alonso playing behind me and Torres, but Real had a great side that night. Iker Casillas, Sergio Ramos, Fabio Cannavaro, Pepe, Gabriel Hense, Arjen Robben, Lassana Diarra, Fernando Gago, Wesley Schneider, Raul and Gonzalo Higuain. Rafael van der Vaart, Guti and Marcelo all came off the bench. They sauntered into Anfield thinking they were going to turn us over. One of the Madrid papers ran a front page with a photograph of Liverpool's ground. Above it was the headline, "So this is the famous Anfield." And there was another below it which said, "So what?" The atmosphere was incredible and we blew them away. They could not handle our tempo, pace and intensity of play. Torres was sensational that night. It was probably one of the best performances I've ever seen from him. Pressing from the front, aggressive, fast, powerful and lethal. Torres gave Sergio Ramos and Pepe a terrible evening. You could see the game meant so much to him against his old team's bitter rivals, and he just could not control Torres. He opened up so much space for me to shine. Real Madrid left Anfield in total shock that night. 5 years and 4 months later, it was my turn to be shocked. On 4th of November 2014, in Madrid, Brendan fielded the deliberately weakened side. We were due to play Chelsea at Anfield on the weekend, and he decided that Balotelli, Sterling, Coutinho, Henderson and I would start on the bench against Real. He supposedly wanted us fresh for Chelsea while he was banking on wins against Ludogorets and Basel in the final group games to take us through to the last 16. That was the night, tucked away in the depths of a dugout at the Bernabeu, when my disappointment ran so deep I almost made up my mind it was time for a change. If Brendan's managing of my games meant that I would have to miss playing against Real in Madrid, it seemed as if I had seen the end. How could I go on playing for Liverpool another year if these were the kind of empty nights that awaited me? I came on in the second half with Coutinho and Sterling, and while it was only a 1-0 defeat, it felt like Brendan had surrendered even before kick-off. My career would never be the same again. The following Saturday, Chelsea were back at Anfield. I think almost everyone who follows English football knows how close I came to leaving Liverpool for Stamford Bridge in July 2005. The saga had been well documented. I have written about it before and its skeleton can be unearthed by a quick search on the internet. But only I can reach deep within myself to dredge up all the conflicting emotions I still remember so vividly. They almost tore me apart on 5th of July 2005. Before, late that same night, I committed myself all over again to Liverpool. That summer day and night, 9 years before, represented the hardest 24 hours of my life. It had begun more than a year earlier, even when I was playing for England in Euro 2004, at a tournament where Wayne Rooney was on fire and we looked to be in with a serious chance of going all the way to a final. My future was being questioned. My England teammates were asking me if I was on my way to Chelsea. Liverpool had just finished the Premier League season 30 points behind Arsenal, and I had serious doubts if we would be able to qualify for the Champions League at the end of the following campaign. In the 2004-05 season, I made it clear to Liverpool that I would discuss a new contract only once I knew whether we would be in a position to sustain a Champions League challenge. Some people might say I was being selfish then, but I was in my prime as a footballer, roaring into my mid-twenties, and I needed some guarantees I would be at a club which could close the 30-point gap between us and the league leaders. I wanted to stay at Liverpool, but I also wanted to play at the highest level. It turned out to be another disappointing Premier League season, and we finished outside the top four, but we had a better time in Europe. We made it all the way to the final in Istanbul, and the club knew I was ready to commit myself to a new contract. I was expecting Liverpool to sign me up, especially as they had already spoken to Igor Biskan and Didi Haman about their new contracts. Looking back now, it seems as if they could have issued a contract offer in the week building up to Istanbul. Would even earlier not have been the perfect time to give your young captain a lift before the biggest game of his life? Sign him up and keep him secure. But I heard nothing from the club in regard to my contract either before the final or after we'd won that amazing game. When I was interviewed soon after I had lifted that monster trophy up into the Turkish sky, I made it clear that I expected to stay at Liverpool. I'm sure the manager and Rick Parry will want to sit down really soon and a decision will be made, I said before I gave into jubilation. How can I leave after a night like this? I wanted to stay, but I heard nothing all through June and the first few days of July. It gave Chelsea, and especially Jose Mourinho, a chance to really get into my head. I'm still not sure, all these years later, why there was no approach from Liverpool to me. I've heard that Rick Parry was away on holiday, and Rafa Benitez was on his break as well. An element in their thinking encouraged a little complacency. He's just won the European Cup. Why would he want to go anywhere else? I had 2 years left on my contract. Compare this with early 2015, when Raheem Sterling was in the same position and Liverpool set about trying to sign a new deal with him. And Sterling had not just won the Champions League. There was neglect in my situation in 2005. I don't know who was to blame, but should they have offered me a contract after the Champions League final? Yes, I think so. I still feel they should have come to me the very next day and said, let's sort this out. It would have killed off all the speculation and saved everyone a lot of heartache. It didn't help that my relationship with Rafa was so distant. I became a little paranoid. I kept asking myself, does Rafa really want to keep me? Or does he want to get as much money for me as he can and build a new team around the players he really likes? I was also confused because I wasn't asking for anything out of the ordinary in terms of football's inflated economy. I was asking for the going rate paid to a top midfielder in Europe. Chelsea offered more money, but that didn't matter. We won the Champions League on 25th of May, and I still had not received a formal offer from Liverpool 5 weeks later. On 1st of July, I told Strawn to start moving and find out what was happening. He called Rick Parry and told him that, in the absence of a new contract, I was prepared to leave. I need a few more days, Rick said. The latest delay gave confidence to Chelsea. They made a formal bid of £32 million. Liverpool rejected it and Rick said the offer was on its way to Strawn. My head was so messed up I began to wonder if they were now just producing a contract as a way of showing the fans that they tried to keep me while they flogged me to Chelsea. I decided to find out. On 5th of July I told Strawn to issue a verbal transfer request. Rick went public with the news and the rest of the day passed in a distressing hum. There were rolling media reports and I stared at the television footage in disbelief. I watched fans burning a Liverpool shirt with my name on the back. For the sake of the cameras, they poured petrol on my old number 17 shirt with Gerrard branded into the material and set it alight outside Melwood. 6 weeks before, on one of the most famous and joyous nights in our history, I had started the comeback which ended in Liverpool glory. We were welcomed home by ecstatic fans. We felt adored because we had pulled off the miracle of Istanbul. It seemed disturbing to then watch my name go up in flames outside Melwood. At least the culprit got £40 from the press for a stunt. I was still sensible enough to know that only a few fans had reacted in such a way, but the intense scrutiny, the consuming nature of being the lead story on the national news that day, upset me. I didn't want that kind of attention. I didn't want the abuse. I actually wanted to play football, ideally for Liverpool, and to try to win a few more trophies. It was that simple. And yet everything had become so dark and tangled. I didn't feel wanted. I didn't feel they had acted as quickly as they should have done. I felt my head would burst and I was popping paracetamol like they were Smarties. I was on the verge of hyperventilating with the stress of it all. Alex was great. She made it clear she would back me whatever decision I took, whether I went to London or stayed in Liverpool. She and Liliella, our only daughter then, would be with me wherever I ended up. I worried about my wife and little girl, wondering how they would adapt to a new life in London, while the same old doubts about my football career raced around my pulsing head. I knew I had to talk to my dad. We arranged for me and my brother Paul to meet up at Dad's that night. It all came tumbling out. I asked Dad, what do you think? What should I do? Dad was calm, and, before he said much, he had me talk through my own feelings. I told Dad and Paul that I didn't think the club had shown me the love I needed. I didn't think that they acted as quickly as they should have done. Chelsea was serious about me and the Mourinho factor dominated much of my thinking. Mourinho would turn my head. I wanted to play football for him, but as soon as I made everything sound so clear I got lost. And I started talking about Liverpool all over again. I spoke so much more about Liverpool than Chelsea. I was so close to leaving Liverpool forever, but that hour with my dad and Paul changed everything. Unlike those players surrounded by people who just see the money piling up, I had family who loved me. The questions they asked concerned my welfare, not my bank balance. What's best for you? What do you want? What will mean more if this happens or that happens? Can you handle the cop turning against you? Can you accept the fact you will never play for Liverpool again? These were the kind of questions, none of them to do with money, that we picked apart inside the four walls of my dad's front room. We all knew I would make millions more if I went to Chelsea, but the money was irrelevant. Dad boiled it down to my driving force, the hope that I would succeed and win trophies as a footballer. Would it mean more to me to win 2 or 3 trophies with Liverpool than double or even triple that number with Chelsea? The question hung in the air. While I turned it over in my head, Paul spoke up. I think he was desperate for me to stay a Liverpool player, but he was my brother before anything else. He said, "Whatever you decide to do, I'm with you." There was no pressure from Paul, just support. But he has said many times since that night, "I'm so happy you stayed." My dad said, "If you look me in the eye and tell me you want this Chelsea move 100%, then I'll be with you all the way. But I don't think you do." I didn't look Dad in the eye. I was far from convinced about Chelsea. I was thinking only of Liverpool. Dad sensed it. "Don't walk away," he eventually said, with powerful simplicity. "Don't leave the club that you love." At 11 o'clock that night, after the most draining day of my life, I called Strom Marshall. "Tell Liverpool I want to stay." Rick Parry might have been the most surprised man in Liverpool when his mobile rang a few minutes later. "I signed my new contract on Friday, the 8th of July 2005, after I'd told Rick to remove the escape clause, which had previously been specified that I would be allowed to move to another club if Liverpool were not performing on the pitch. I never wanted to think about leaving Liverpool ever again." The internal debate was far less tortured in the winter of 2014. It had been different in the summer of 2005, when there were flames both outside Anfield and inside my head. At the age of 34, I could adopt a measured approach as I weighed up my options and decided whether I would stay for another year at Liverpool. With all the doubt and uncertainty that would entail about my playing future, or seek out a potential new career in America, it helped that I had ruled out many of the complications. Unlike in 2005, when I'd faced the upsetting prospect of returning to Anfield to play against Liverpool in the blue of Chelsea, I was now adamant I would never sign for any other club that might play a competitive match against Liverpool. That ruled out every club in England and Europe. America was my only realistic alternative to remaining for another year with Liverpool. I felt strangely relaxed as I decided, for once, to put my family first and consider a future that might be good for all of us, rather than just my football career. When Strong told me about Liverpool's offer in November 2014, I could easily have sent him back to insist on negotiating improved terms. But the pain of being on the bench against Real Madrid mattered more. The financial side of any deal didn't really interest me, and so Strom never discussed anything more with Ian. I just spoke to Brendan. I said, "Look, we've had the offer, and it's not about money. It's more me needing time to think what's best for my future." Brendan understood, and, as always, there was a very good exchange between us. He said I could take as long as I needed to make up my mind. Soon after the reduced contract offer had been made by Liverpool, the club asked me to appear in an advert for Nivea. It was clear that I was still important to Liverpool off the field, but I turned it down. In the end, Jordan Henderson stepped in, and when I saw the ad on television, I was mighty relieved. Doing those kind of ads just isn't me. I've had tons of offers to advertise products bare-chested, and I've always said no. Maybe that's why, unlike most leading players, I've never asked for an image rights deal with Liverpool. Strawn has checked with me a few times. Should we get an image rights clause in the contract? And I've always said no. I've heard the players around the dressing room talking about image rights and how much it will earn them. Personally, I think it's disgusting for a player to ask for image rights from his club. My belief is that when you sign a contract with your club, then you sign your image rights over to them. They pay you well anyway, and you're working for them. Maybe it's different if you're Messi or Ronaldo. But the Nivea advert was one request from the club I could turn down. I have filled so many commercial obligations for Liverpool over the years because it's part of my responsibility as captain. I had reached a stage of my life where I wasn't prepared to do any more. I'm too old for that now anyway, but I could give you a long list of stuff I've turned down over the years that would have brought me big financial rewards. My career has been about football. Neither vast amount of money nor a celebrity image really interests me. Of course, I've got 3 kids to worry about, but I became financially secure in my early 20s. I know how lucky I've been that I've not had to make any decision concerning football or my future on a financial basis for the last 12 years or more. So I had no problem when it became apparent that if I decided to play Major League Soccer in America with LA Galaxy, it would be for less money than I would have received if I'd stayed at Liverpool. And it's also why, at the same time, I turned down €13.5 million net deal to play in Qatar for 2 years. That sort of money would obviously have been more than I'd ever earned, but Qatar was not the right place for me and my family. America was much more appealing. MLS would allow me both to continue playing the game at a decent level for a few more years and to spend some proper time with Alex and the girls, away from the pressure cooker life of Liverpool. Professionally, I could not have accepted becoming a squad player. I remember watching Frank Lampard, a great player and a close contemporary of mine, sitting on the bench for Manchester City week after week after he left Chelsea. I don't think I could have followed that same route. I always want to be playing. I felt that even more acutely on 29th of November 2014, on the 16th anniversary of my Liverpool first team debut, when Brendan had me start a match at home against Stoke on the bench. We were between our final Champions League group games, and I could see the sense in being rested, but I didn't like it much. Many people just see the wealth and glamour of a life in football. They don't perhaps understand that it's also difficult playing for a club like Liverpool. It's testing on the pitch, and far more challenging off it. In my home city, you meet Liverpool and Everton fans wherever you go, and it becomes impossible to lead a normal life. I can only be myself, the person I really like, when I'm not on edge or having to be careful all the time. That happens only when I'm either at home or at Melwood. It's the same for most footballers at the top level. People sometimes forget that. If you take away our wages and fame, we're just normal human beings who like doing what everyone else likes doing. We're not that special. And that's why I've always felt it's important to stay grounded. I want people to respect me as a person and as a player rather than someone who is just lucky enough to earn millions. It's far more important to me to be as normal as possible. But even something as simple as taking the girls for a swim at the local pool or picking them up from the dance classes or gym lessons is often not possible. I can't be an ordinary dad because I'm swamped by football fans, either cheering me or abusing me wherever I go. That's wearing. Even when things are going well and people just want to pat you on the back or shake your hand. But I certainly don't want to put up with all the abuse when I'm with me girls. When you're an international, the same thing happens all over the country. Even in London, I get stopped every couple of minutes for a picture, or someone comes over to the table when you're having a meal with your family. After 17 years in my surreal and pressured world of professional football, I'm desperate for some stress-free anonymity. Especially over the past year or so. I sometimes take my concerns home with me. Alex understands because it's my job and she knows that I love it. But I began to feel in late 2014 that it was time to put her and the kids first for a change. In America, I could do that. When we started talking to people in MLS, it became clear that it was likely to be a choice between LA or New York. Two or three other clubs were also interested, but I was always pulled towards the idea of LA. The hustle and bustle of New York is not really my scene. I prefer the more laid-back lifestyle of California. I spoke to Robbie Keane and David Beckham and they raved about Los Angeles and LA Galaxy. Beck sent me so many texts about LA. He knew Alex and the girls would love it out there. He also said, "The football can be challenging with the travelling, the heat and the humidity, but the level is improving all the time. You'll love your teammates, you'll love the club. It's a good setup, good facilities, but the key will be you'll absolutely love it with your family." He ended by saying, "I miss it every day." Thierry Henry also gave me some advice. He was still playing in New York, but he said, "If you get the chance, go to the MLS. LA Galaxy are a very good organisation." As winter in England began to bite, I felt more certain. It would soon be time for a change. In early December 2014, as the end closed in on my Champions League nights, I'd become more reflective at home. The great victories and the harsh defeats unfolded in a blaze of colour and a maze of memories. I also amused myself by remembering the most bizarre and hilarious European encounters of all, when we played Barcelona at the Nou Camp on 21st of February 2007. The real shenanigans had taken place on the Algarve where, a week earlier, we had gone to prepare for the game at a special warm weather training camp. It was meant to be a team bonding exercise because we were the clear underdogs. We went into the game thinking we needed camaraderie and togetherness to survive against the slick Barcelona team in front of a fevered crowd of 88,000. So the idea was that we would train hard and prepare well, but Rafa Benitez had also agreed we could have one free night to enjoy a couple of beers together as a team. He expected us to be back at Valle do Lobo around 11 p.m. I know that part of Portugal so well that the breakdown was probably my fault. After years of playing golf on the Algarve, I knew that the place for a good time and a bit of karaoke was Monty's. I called the owner and made a booking. I then took everyone down there and we were having a brilliant night until the karaoke got a bit out of hand. It's all a little bit hazy now, but I remember Craig Bellamy pressuring John Arnorisa to go up on stage and belt out a song. Bellamy was winding Ginge up mercilessly. He had not forgotten that Ginge had missed the Christmas party a few months before, where, as a new player, he was meant to sing a song. Bellamy kept saying, "It's your go, Ginge, it's your go. You can't get out of it this time, you ginger bastard." Reese is a bit like me. He's not a karaoke singer. He turned on Bellamy and said, "No, you fucking get up. You're making such a fucking noise, being on me case. You get up and have a go." Bellas didn't like it. He's a bit of a otter, and he and Ginge were soon nose to nose. It got a bit too heavy, all that, "I'll fucking kill you, you ginger twat," while Ginge really did look ready to murder Bellamy. We calmed him down eventually, and Ginge went back to the hotel with the hump. He was sharing with Daniel Agger. Daniel didn't want to leave Monty's because he was still having a good time, and so Ginge said he would leave the latch off their door so Agger could get in without waking him up. The rest of us stayed at Monty's. People went over the top on the booze. I remember Jersey Dudek being in a terrible state. Normally Jersey's the nicest fella on the planet, but after a night on the drink he came out of Monty's wanting to fight the security guards and the police. He wanted to take on the world. I think that's when most of us realised, a little blearily, it was time to call it a night. I got back to my room and had only been there a few minutes when I heard the boss outside my door. Rafa banged hard, sounding pretty pissed off. I answered the door, trying to look like I'd been in bed for a few hours. "What's going on?" Rafa said. He was colder than ever. To maintain my just-woken-up scam, I threw in a few black yawns and rubbed my eyes.
"I don't know, boss,"
I said, trying not to breathe alcohol fumes all over Rafa. "Risa and Bellamy are fighting," Rafa said icily. "Where is everyone else?" "Leave it to me, boss," I said. "I'll go and see what's happening." There was a party in one of the lads' bedrooms. It was carnage, and Steve Finnan looked like he'd either seen a ghost or witnessed a murder. I soon worked out it was closer to murder. Finn had got back to his room and found Bellamy in a raging mood. Bella said, "Right, I'm going to get him." The Welsh wizard took an 8-iron, his favourite club, out of his golf bag. Finnan was very worried then because Bellamy looked half crazy. He went off to Ginger Nagger's room, carrying his 8-iron. Finn chased after him, but Bellas was quick. Of course, the latch had been left off the door, and so Bellas went straight in and started walloping Risa with the 8-iron. Ginge, who was in his boxer shorts in bed, went into protection mode, covering himself up. Finnan arrived and managed to stop Bellamy doing any more damage. It was like a morgue at breakfast the next morning. We heard that the club had received a police complaint about Jersey's behaviour, and Rafa was not happy. Everyone was hungover, and Ginger's legs were covered in bruises. It didn't look good, and it was already all over the internet. The papers back home went to town. The club was furious as it was disastrous PR. A player attacking his own teammate with a golf club just before a big Champions League game was not the kind of behaviour that went down well with anyone, from owners to sponsors. I think some of our fans might have enjoyed it because it was a crazy story, but it was serious too. Bellas and Ginge were completely different characters, and I always expected there might be fireworks between them. They both fancied themselves. I'd seen teammates go head-to-head before, and there had been a couple of handbag moments and some nasty banter flying round, but never anything that dangerous. If I had been in Ginger's shoes, I don't think I would have stood for it. It was totally out of order, especially over something as stupid as an argument in a karaoke bar like good old Monty's. Rafa handled it with a surprisingly light touch. He wasn't pleased, but he got the players to shake hand, and he moved us on quickly. In a weird way, it was almost as if the incident helped the team, by taking everyone's mind off how intimidating it was going to be at Camp Nou. The media were all over it, and the party lines were that Bellamy would not be allowed to play. But the TV, radio and newspaper boys didn't know Rafa like I did, and it was no surprise to me when he told us the team. Risa was playing, bruised legs and all, and so was Bellamy. Rafa's strategic brain took charge. He cut out all the emotion of Monty's and the night of the 8-iron. Rafa likes to play deep and compact when away in big games like Barcelona, and so you need speed on the counter-attack. Bellamy had electric pace. It made sense that Rafa played him, and he knew we needed Risa at full-back on the counter too, against the reigning champions. Even when Deco scored early to put Barca 1-0 up after just 14 minutes, our spirit stayed strong. As Bellamy would insist, we were still in the swing. A few minutes before half-time, Xabi Alonso's free kick found Finnan, who, having recovered from being the main witness to the 8-iron attack, whipped in a beauty of a cross. Bellamy drifted away from the slack Barcelona marker and powered in a header towards goal. Victor Valdez tried to scoop it out, but the ball had crossed the line. Dirk Kuyt followed up and knocked it in again, but it was Bellamy's goal. Our ecstasy turned to hilarity when we saw Bellamy's celebration. He made space for himself and swung an invisible 8-iron. I was pissing myself at the sight of Bellamy's craziness, but I felt for Ginge. I knew he was still very upset as he really took the golf club assault to heart. I would have felt the same. Ronaldinho and a long-haired Lionel Messi came close, but so did we on numerous occasions. Valdez kept out my free kick and Kuyt should have scored. But there was no stopping us on the follow-up when Bellamy, of course, showed lovely vision to find, naturally, Riise. Ginge hit a right-foot screamer, rather than his usual left-foot thunderbolt, into Barcelona's goal. His celebration, and ours, was riotous. Ginge did not reach for his imaginary 8-iron. He slid along the glistening green turf and screamed. We beat Barcelona 2-1 that night. Riise was very diplomatic. It was destiny for both of us to score, I think, he said. Both Bellamy and myself have had a difficult run-up, but we've put it behind us when it mattered. His celebration didn't bother me. Look, he's had a difficult time as well, and I could see it meant a lot to him. I'm happy for him, as is the whole team. Bellas just grinned. Rather than feeling the hand of destiny, he was gobsmacked. Liverpool went all the way to the Champions League final that year. We lost to AC Milan in Athens, and maybe missed a trick by not returning to the Algarve and Monty's for a team bonding session before the final. I'm not sure if Ginge ever really forgave Bellamy, but between them, they gave us one of our greatest Champions League memories as not many teams win at the Camp Nou. 10 years is a long time in ordinary life. In football, it feels even longer. 10 years is an age. It's almost an era. A whole generation of players and games. So much had happened to Liverpool and me over the past 10 years. We had won and lost 2 Champions League finals. We had been in the High Court and a title race. We had been through 3 sets of owners. We'd had 4 different managers. But just one captain. I had become club captain in 2003 and led my country as well. I had got married and become a father to 3 girls. I had passed the 690 game mark for Liverpool and won over 100 caps for England. I had also decided it would soon be time to swap Liverpool for Los Angeles. There have been times of tumult and delight, worry and glory, uncertainty and utter conviction. Most of all, it had been an unforgettable 10 years between Liverpool playing at home against Olympiacos on 8 December 2004 and the visit of Basel to Anfield on 9 December 2014. Both games were desperate Champions League group deciders. In 2004 we needed to beat Olympiacos by 2 clear goals to qualify for the knockout stages. 10 years later it was simpler. Victory over Basel, even by a single goal, would be enough to help us qualify for the last 16 of the Champions League after a scrappy round of group games. I felt the weight of years when it was pointed out that one of our key players, Raheem Sterling, had turned 10 on the day of our memorable encounter with Olympiacos. He would turn 20 the day before we played Basel. Liverpool had signed 75 players over those 10 years, at a cost of £520 million. I had seen a staggering number of footballers walk into Melwood between 2004 and 2014. I watched every single one of the first training sessions with close attention, wondering whether we bought a star or another dud, a King or a Pratt, a Xabi Alonso or an El Hadj Diouf, a Luis Suarez or a Mario Balotelli. It was clear Alonso was royalty after our first training session together, and Rafa Benitez, who had been so clever to buy him in the first place, was equally stupid to sell him to Real Madrid 5 years later. The loss of a great player hurt even more than the arrival of 5 bad new signings. When Rafa arrived at the club as our new manager before the start of 2004-05 season, his first 4 buys were all Spanish. Josemi from Malaga, Antonio Nunes from Real Madrid, Xabi Alonso from Real Sociedad, and Luis Garcia from Barcelona. It helped sweep in a small Spanish revolution which transformed the club and ended in our becoming champions of Europe at the end of Rafa's first season. Alonso already had a Liverpool connection even before he arrived at the club. At Sociedad, he had been coached by John Toshack, one of the great Liverpool strikers and an astute manager. Toshack paid a lot of attention to Alonso, who became captain at Sociedad at a young age, and so the links were already in place. Alonso was a revelation at Liverpool from 2004 to 2009, and, by some distance, the best central midfielder I have ever played alongside. It was a disastrous decision to sell Alonso, and especially for just £30 million, which looks like a snip now when you reflect on what he has achieved subsequently, both at Real Madrid and Bayern Munich and with Spain, winning the Euros and the World Cup. I blame Rafa entirely for the loss of Alonso. Rafa phoned me to ask if I would help him sign Gareth Barry, my England teammate. He actually wanted Gareth to replace Xabi. Gareth was a very good player, but Xabi was world class. It was crazy. But Rafa got it into his head that Alonso was not for him. He wanted Alonso out, and Barry in as his replacement. Alonso went back to Spain, and it saddened me. Xabi Alonso could still be playing for Liverpool 6 or 7 years later, so why should he have left at the age of 27, while he still had almost 3 years left on his contract? Mascherano wanted to go, and he refused to play until he got his move. Torres came to me to ask for help to leave, and he downed tools until he went to Chelsea. Xabi Alonso never once said to me he wanted to move. I think more about the special players we lost, Alonso, Torres and Suarez, than the terrible signings which we got lumbered. I don't really want to waste time thinking about El Hadj Diouf, but it's worth highlighting his wasted seasons at Liverpool as an example of how it can all go wrong. Gerard Houllier, a very good manager and usually a wise judge of character, signed Diouf in the summer of 2002. Gerard bought Diouf for £10 million from Lens, solely on the recommendation of his former assistant, Patrice Berg, who had coached Diouf there. In the 2002 World Cup, Diouf played very well for Senegal and they reached the quarter-finals. I understood why Gerard rushed through the signing, but he did not really know Diouf as a person. He was one of three new signings which were meant to turn Liverpool into Premier League champions. We had finished as runners-up to Manchester United the season before, and a combination of Diouf, Salif Jow and Bruno Cheyroux was supposed to drive us to the title. It was probably the biggest waste of £18 million in Liverpool's history. We finished the season in 5th place, and Diouf had sealed his place at the top of the list of Liverpool signings I least liked. It seemed to me that Diouf had no real interest in football, and he cared nothing about Liverpool. For example, the way he spat a huge gobule of gunky phlegm at a Celtic fan in the UEFA Cup match at Parkhead in March 2003 summed up his contemptuous and spiteful demeanour. A few people have since asked me if I saw any comparison between Diouf and Mario Balotelli. I've always said no. I've got respect for Balotelli. I've got none for Diouf. Balotelli can be endearing sometimes, and that's never a trait that you would associate with Diouf. The only positive aspect of the otherwise ugly signing of Diouf is that he worked hard on the pitch. He always wanted the ball, and he never hid. But after a while I decided Diouf simply wasn't your usual footballer. It seemed to me as if football got in the way of his social life. At least Balotelli can make me smile sometimes. I have a small hope that one day, his career might work out and he can prove his potential on a regular basis. Balotelli had cost £16 million of the £120 million we'd spent building a team to play Basel in our last Champions League group game in December 2014. But on the day, he was not even in the squad as he was struggling with a mild groin complaint or a more complicated dent in his mentality. I tried to concentrate on Basel, but everyone kept reminding me of my wonder goal against Olympiacos. It was the case of growing old as a footballer. There was always another anniversary, another echo of the past to remind you of faded time. There was always another game, whether it had ended in victory or defeat, to offer up an omen for today. Sometimes the anniversaries and matches, the nights and the goals blurred like ghosts of my past. Some, however, will always stand out like beacons in my head. Olympiacos is one. Basel is another, though the reasons couldn't be more different.